Hey, what's up? John Doherty here for Radio Tacoma's Climate Talk. Did you see that item in the Seattle Times a few days ago? Scientists have determined that Mount Rainier has lost half its ice since the early 1900s. Hotter and more violent weather, unprecedented wildfire smoke, all these things and others are a daily litany of the impacts of our changing climate, change driven primarily by fossil fuel emissions. So how do we make progress in our effort to avoid the worst? One way is to understand the economics of climate change. What are people's and industries' economic incentives as they make daily decisions related to energy use? And what do we do to change incentives that are leading to a worsening climate? Today we're talking with Dr. Kelsey Carlston, who teaches and researches microeconomics at Gonzaga University. I'll be asking her to shed some light on just those topics. So here we go. Well, Dr. Kelsey Carlston, Gonzaga University, good morning and welcome to Climate Talk.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, well, I appreciate you taking the time out to talk to us about the economic impacts, the way you see them, that are affecting climate change. And I guess really that means how we as people behave economically and how that does impact climate change. But let's start off just briefly. Give us a bit of background about who you are, where you're from, your schools, and how you got to Gonzaga University.
Okay, yeah, so I grew up in the Appalachian Mountains of Virginia, and I went to Virginia Tech as an undergrad, and I started in chemistry and then realized that people are more interesting than chemicals. And so I switched to economics, and I thought it was really an interesting way of looking at the world. And so when I was an undergrad, I was really bought into the whole idea of how economics treats a lot of things. And then I worked for a few years in California. Then I moved to Utah to do graduate school at the University of Utah. And there I kind of changed my views a little bit on how realistic some of the assumptions that the field of economics makes are. And so most of my graduate school, I was poking around in that a little bit more. And my dissertation was on intergenerational economic mobility and inequality. So those are pretty important fields, I think. And then I just started at Gonzaga University last year as an assistant professor of economics. So I'm not a climate economist or a climate scientist of any kind, but I do think that some of the fundamental aspects of economics are something that I can weigh in on and, you know, explain how they're related to climate change and climate policy.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm assuming that we're going to be able to kind of put in layperson terms some of these concepts. I think, speaking as myself as a layperson, one of the things that happens listening to economists, they tend to just kind of instantly dive into the weeds. And it's like, what the heck are these people talking about? So that's what I'm part of my vision for today. Now, I know that you are a microeconomist. At least I think that's true. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
So I guess the other kind of economist would be a macroeconomist. What exactly is a microeconomist and how does it differ from what we would normally think of as just, well, an economist?
Yeah, so microeconomics, okay, so macroeconomics usually is based out of microeconomics. And macroeconomics, you're looking at how everything works together to make the economy as we see it and how does trade and monetary policy affect how the economy works. Whereas microeconomics is more considering, you know, how do we allocate resources in a world where there is scarcity? And there's always scarcity. And so it's how do individuals make decisions? How do firms make decisions? And what do those things mean for our economy? And actually, I'm an applied microeconomist, which means that I'm looking at, I use data and econometric methods to test the theory. And so I'm actually looking at, okay, this is the information we have and how well does that reflect on the theories that economists make.
So the health or validity of the data is really going to be a big part of what the conclusions are, I would imagine.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. Yeah, so, and it's a big world out there. And of course, climate, one of the factors of climate change. You may have heard it referred to as a hyper object. It's something that's so big that there isn't anybody anywhere in any field who can get their arms wrapped around the whole thing. So I guess we just sort of do the best we can, which frankly, right now isn't very good. I think we could be doing a lot better in terms of climate change. But anyway, I digress. So let's talk about some of the concepts. In an earlier interchange with you, you mentioned several things: a principal agent problem, collective action common pool resource problem, free riders, and my favorite is negative externalities, because I think this is such a big deal and so easy to gloss over. In fact, I was thinking before we connected today that in a certain sense, we kind of love our negative externalities because it's a way of shifting costs. But anyway, let's go through those one at a time. So talk a little bit about, and all of these, to the extent you can, apply them to climate change issues. So what is the principal agent problem?
Okay, the principal agent problem. Well, I guess I would like to start, with the basic idea, the basic starting point for economics and microeconomics is that markets do a good job of allocating resources.
Okay.
And the problem is that sometimes they don't. So the question for all of these problems is, when don't markets do a great job of allocating resources? When don't they give us the best possible world? And so all of these problems that I want to talk about today are times when markets don't do a great job. And usually what that means is somebody needs to come correct the markets, and that almost always is government intervention. So the principal agent problem is when people are making choices on behalf of others, and those people are self-interested. So an example would be if a business owner has a cashier that they hired, and they want the cashier to act like they would act if they were being the cashier. So they want the cashier to be working all of the time. They want them to be very good at customer service, things like that. But the cashier just wants a paycheck, and then they want to do as little work as possible while still getting that paycheck. So this is the principal agent problem. And usually to fix those kinds of problems, the business owner, say, could increase their monitoring. So when you go to the grocery store, a lot of times they hand you the receipt and they're like, will you please fill out this survey? This is a way of monitoring the cashier to make sure they're not slacking on the job and to try to reduce the problems of the principal agent problem. And then tying performance and pay. And I think there this is relevant for climate change, is that the people who are making decisions, the biggest decisions about our climate policy, are not, they're self-interested. So they're making decisions for the whole society based on their own individual desires and wants. So policymakers and politicians, they're receiving campaign donations. They're getting other kinds of benefits from fossil fuel companies. They're trying to do all of this while maintaining their position of power. And it's not worked well so far. We haven't had very serious climate action. I mean, we've had a little bit here and there, but it's not the level that we need in order to really fix the climate problem. And so in order to fix the principal agent problem, I think what we need is to have increased monitoring, just like the business owner with the cashier. And we need transparency in governance. We need to be aware of what's going on, what the politicians are doing, and it needs to be clear what's happening. And then we also need to tie performance and pay. So we need to make sure that politicians are held accountable for what they're doing or not doing about climate change. And so I think here is a kind of a call to action of, we need to vote, and we need to make sure that democracy stays strong so that, these people are held accountable and they have to be at least somewhat not self-interested. And then also reducing the incentives or conflicts of interest for not having climate action. So campaign finance reform or laws about conflicts of interest, I think these things would help us to hold people accountable so that when they're acting as agents for the American population or the global population, they're acting more on our interests rather than theirs.
Yeah, so I can see the absolute truth of that. And of course, one of the things you touched on there is the idea of citizen engagement, which is something that does seem so critically important here, because there are all these other interests that may not have the larger society's interests at the top of their list of priorities. It does seem like one of the problems here, maybe, and I'm not so sure there's an economics problem, but I'll just toss it out there anyway, that we have people who are influencing government who are very concentrated in terms of their interests and their power, like the fossil fuel industry, for instance. Whereas, let's just say I and my family and my friends and my town and all those things, issues around what's going on in Washington, D.C. with legislation may impact us, but it's just a little tiny bit. I mean, we're dispersed. And so is this an economics problem, or is this just a political science problem?
Yeah, I think that probably would be more of a political science problem. I mean, actually, we can talk about that as a collective action problem, which I think we were going to get to later in the podcast, but that would definitely fall under the collective action problem.
Okay, well, let's just jump right into that. And that's kind of next on our list. So collective action, common pool resource problem. So what's that?
All right. So the common pool resource problem. Common pool resources are goods that you can't keep people from using, but they are rival, meaning that if you use it, then it takes some away from my use. Or so like a big example is you have a pond with a bunch of fish, and everybody likes to go fishing. But at the end of the day, a lot of people end up overfishing, and we reduce the stock of fish to where they can't replenish. And this is called the tragedy of the commons. Mm. We have this common resource that we over-extract, and it makes everybody worse off. Nobody wants the pond to have zero fish. They just want to have a few fishes for themselves. So what happens in this kind of problem is that the individuals have the incentive to consume as much as they want, even if they would prefer a world where they consume less for longer, so where the pond still has fish. You know, if people were to choose, they might say, yeah, I'd rather only have one or two fishes a year and keep the pond. But given the incentives I'm given, where everybody else is going to fish as much as they want anyways, I'm going to fish as much as I want. So this is kind of the collective action problem, is if we could get everybody to agree to only take a few fishes a year, then everybody would be happier. But it's so hard to coordinate. It's so hard to make sure that everybody's doing what the community wants. And so even if you were to get, let's say, you know, the fish has 100 people, and you were to get 8 of your closest friends to say, all right, we'll all do the not overfishing thing. We'll all be responsible in our use. Well, now there's even more fish in the pond. You might have a more successful fishing day. And so those 20 other people have more incentive to go and overfish. And those people would be called free riders. They're benefiting from the action of other people. So collective action, trying to get everybody to do something together, is very, very challenging. And it has a lot of cost of, there are transaction costs, meaning that there's a lot of coordinating that is time consuming and difficult. And then at the end of the day, you still have free riders. So in the example of, you know, people, everybody trying to get together to do climate action, you know, it may be that 80% of Americans believe that climate action is very important, but it's very hard to get everybody to come and do the same kind of action. And even if you could get a lot of people to get involved, it does take time to go out and, you know, write your senators and march in the streets. And so a lot of people choose not to do that because they say, well, at least other people are taking care of it. Other people are out there marching for me. And so it's a very challenging problem. Another way that you can apply the common pool resource problem to climate change is the emissions example. So, you know, I would rather fly only once a year, and drive less, and, you know, maybe not eat as much meat, as long as I could be assured that my actions would mean that there wouldn't be climate change. But in a world where, you know, everybody's going to do what they want to do and my actions won't prevent climate change, I can cut back all I want and climate change isn't going to be averted. I'm just going to go do the same kind of actions that everybody else is doing. So I fly as much as I want. I drive as much as I want. I eat meat and all this. And so you could think of the clean air or a good environment as a common pool resource as something that people are overdrawing from. And so we need some kind of collective action to cut down on our emissions and prevent climate change from occurring. So yeah, the only so, way, sorry, no, so to no, solve the common pool, sorry?
No, you go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, so to solve the common pool resource problem, usually what you need is you need some kind of governing agency. So everybody has to be made to consume less. So in the fishing example, what we do is we have limits on the amount that you can fish each year or hunt each year to make sure that we keep the stocks where we want. So what we need is worldwide governance of the biggest polluters, or to make sure that people are required to pollute less. And we may end up in a world that everybody likes better, even though they had to cut down on their consumption, right? So it's an optimal solution when we have everybody cutting down, but we won't get there on our own because of that collective action problem and free rider problem. So yeah, that's the biggest thing we can do is have some kind of regulation. But also if we can change incentives for people so that it's not in people's best interest to pollute. So maybe the technology is better, you know, maybe electric cars are pretty fun to drive. They go pretty fast. So maybe if we had it so that electric cars were more in people's best interest, they'd be more willing to do things like that.
Yeah, right now I'm thinking there's a behavioral economist named Dan Ariely that I've come to admire. And what you're sketching out there to me is an aspect of what one of my favorite quotes of his. And he said, if we were to design a problem that human beings are uniquely poorly suited to address, it would be climate change. Because as you sketch these economic concepts out, and I can see them all at work in the world, and it seems like there are so many incentives or disincentives to do, for lack of a better term, to do the wrong thing, that it's, and then you tie that in with what you referred to there is like, oh, well, it's a lot of trouble to write to my senator and march in the street and so on and so forth. So I'll just leave that to somebody else to do. And I mean, most Americans do that. I mean, probably most people around the world, one of the personal experiences I had in that, I was at a rally around climate change. It happened to be on a Sunday afternoon, and there were maybe 100 people there, which was a nice turnout for that rally. But I thought, you know, the Mariners are playing baseball this afternoon, and there's 40,000 people there, which is kind of a measure of where people's interests are. So I guess for the moment anyway, what we do is we keep plugging along and doing the right thing. By we, I'm talking about people who are actively concerned about climate change. And you use the term tragedy of the commons. And I know that usually when that term is referred to, it's referred to in about a pretty small thing, like the village green or the pond that you referred to or something like that. But I mean, really, the atmosphere, the oceans, those are commons that everybody is using. And of course, industry and others have really good reasons to dump pollution into those bodies. And I made a reference earlier, it seems almost like we like our ability to do that. Like there's a big article in the Seattle Times yesterday about gasoline prices in Washington State that are the highest in the United States right now because, the finger is being pointed at the cap and invest program. And I can see a big rebellion coming that no, we would rather just pollute than to do things to reduce that pollution. So a little rant there for me. So any comments on what I said there?
Yeah, I mean, I do think it's hard to take action yourself when you don't think it's going to end up doing anything in the end. You know, like I, growing up a millennial or being a millennial, I have a very strong aversion to plastics because you get told so much about the harms of plastics. And, so I do a lot of things. I reuse plastic bags. I try not to buy anything with plastic in it and, avoid some things that you can't buy without plastic. And then I go home to my parents and they're not paying any attention at all. You know, it's just plastic forks and spoons because I don't feel like doing the dishes and things like that. And when you get faced with those kinds of things, it's very hard to say, okay, I'm going to keep hurting myself for something I believe in when I really look at what's going on and don't think it's going to even be a drop in the bucket. So I think that there's a little bit of a behavioral aspect there, but also it wouldn't make sense. I mean, who wants to be the one who's suffering for something that won't make a difference in the end? And I can see why people don't want to be paying higher gas prices just for that. And that's why you do need this overall governing agency. It's not something, you know, we can hurt ourselves all we want, but unless we have some big governing agency that's making not only people in the U.S., but we need worldwide action to prevent climate change from occurring. And, while I do think we all should do whatever we can, it also doesn't make sense to be one of the, you know, few who's fighting against it.
Yeah, so I think that probably one of the things there is that policy-wise, we should be striving to take actions that people can look at and see that they're actually benefiting from those policies while the climate change issues or the emissions issues are mitigated at the same time. So then it's like, okay, well, it's in my interest to change this behavior. And whereas if the goal was just simply to be a good person, then that might not have so much impact. So I've bandied about this term negative externalities a bit. Could you talk about that in layperson terms, just what is that and how is that impacting our environment and the climate?
Sure. So externalities are costs or benefits that happen to people outside of a transaction. So, you know, I buy something and I consume it. And if somebody outside of that transaction is hurt or helped, those are externalities, the benefits or costs that are put on those people. I mean, there are positive externalities and negative externalities. So positive externality, like if I have flowers on my porch and everybody who's walked by my porch gets to enjoy those flowers, that's a positive externality. Yeah. Or, you know, an educated workforce, educating young people has positive externalities for everybody. And then negative externalities are things that hurt people outside of the transaction. So if somebody has a really loud car, they may enjoy it, but they may not enjoy it to make up for all of the people who don't enjoy having a loud car around. And so what you end up with is, you know, if everybody were to pool together, they might say, wow, like that person's loud car is really annoying. So let's all pay him $100 so that he'll change his car. So it's not so loud. And, you know, while it may not be worth $100 to any individual person, maybe, you know, the 100 people are on the block are all like, yeah, I would pay $1 to make that guy's car quieter, right? So if we had this socially optimal outcome, the guy wouldn't have a loud car and he'd be paid $100 to not have the loud car. But what outcome we get is that the guy has a loud car and everybody else is annoyed. So the thing with emissions is that the socially optimal outcome would be that people don't pollute. And, or maybe if we have this right to pollute, we would have everybody band together who cares about climate change and say, okay, we're going to pay the people who would be polluting otherwise some amount of money so that they don't pollute and we don't have climate change in the end. So, that might be the socially optimal outcome, but it's not the outcome that we get to if markets are free. So, you know, to change the socially optimal outcome, get to the socially optimal outcome, we can do a lot of different things. So like for education, because we want people to be educated, we all pitch in to increase the level of education. We all pay taxes so that our young people get to go to school and become, you know, better citizens, better workforce members, things like that. And then for negative externalities, a lot of times we have rules and regulations, and we can also add prices to negative externalities. So we have a gas tax already. And usually the gas tax, because anybody who drives on the road is damaging it just a little bit. And so we want to make sure that the people who are driving are the ones who are paying for that negative externality. So we call that internalizing the externality. Another example is like plastic grocery bags. So plastic is not very good for the environment. And a lot of municipalities and states have decided, okay, if you're going to use a plastic bag, you have to pay for it because you are costing somebody for that plastic bag. And so those kinds of things can be used to make externalities not costly to the people around. But there are a lot of challenges with trying to internalize the externality, and these are really big with emissions. So one is that it's really difficult to value the cost of externality, which I think we'll talk later about how we quantify the cost of climate change. And it's difficult to enforce. So sometimes if you're doing something, you know, like with the loud cars, we do have laws in a lot of places that say you can't have loud cars, but it's really difficult to enforce. It's difficult to make sure that people are following the rules or paying for whatever their externality is. And then another problem is that even when we have tried to internalize externalities, a lot of times it's really poorly applied. And so you end up getting things where people say, well, that policy didn't make any sense and it didn't actually change people's behavior. These things can all make it really difficult to figure out how to deal with negative externalities. But, you know, what most economists suggest is that we should be having taxes on carbon because polluting does have a negative externality. We should be pricing carbon and taxing people for emitting. But so far, there's only been a handful of instances where I think that's been applied well.
Yeah, I'm active with Citizens Climate Lobby, and one, our focus over the years has been on putting that price on carbon. And my understanding from the data is that economists widely support that idea. We're gonna put a price on carbon, and therefore people will use less of it, and we can use the proceeds to mitigate, and so on and so forth. It does seem like, well, it is a massive problem, as you've pointed out. And one of the things is that the effects, for instance, of pollution, of burning fossil fuels, and let's forget about climate change for a second, just the other things like small particle pollution and those kinds of things, they're so dispersed. And the people who are suffering from those things, generally speaking, it's hard to identify, okay, this person has got asthma or some other issue because of small particle pollution. And drawing the connection between the two is extremely difficult. So I guess we do get back to the engagement thing that you brought up earlier. I certainly like the idea of putting a price on these externalities versus paying somebody to not damage me. I mean, that almost feels like extortion. And just as an aside, I mean, I think Puget Sound Energy out here in Western Washington has really headed in that direction in terms of buying carbon offsets and to continue polluting. And yet the ratepayers are going to pay for those offsets because Puget Sound Energy by law is entitled to get a return on whatever money it spends. It just seems like a bizarre set of incentives there. So we talked about costs, and you alluded to there are ways that we can at least take a shot at understanding what the costs of fossil fuel emissions are around the world. So could you speak to that a little bit?
Well, you know, again, I'm not a climate economist, but from the reading that I've done and the understanding that I have of cost-benefit analysis, which is what people use to price carbon, I really think that there's been a lot of problems with the way that we've tried to price carbon. So there's a number of things like how do you value wetlands and ecosystems and smoke from wildfires? I think a lot of the things that for the smoke from wildfires, I mean, that one in Washington feels very important to me. A lot of the ways that they value it is, okay, if anybody's trying to value it, they look at the health costs of the smoke from wildfires. Or maybe they look at days of lost work for people who can't go work outside. But what it doesn't take into account is how unpleasant it is to live in a place where sometimes for a month out of the year, you can't go outside and you can't go do the things that make Washington so fun a place to be in. And so those values aren't really incorporated. And from my understanding, there's not been very much done to try to get those kinds of social costs, those kinds of preferences. And there are ways that we can do that, but they're really imperfect. And in other fields where we've been trying to do those kinds of valuations for a long time, I still don't think that we're in a good place where we can say, oh yes, this is the cost of this thing. The other problem with calculating the social cost of carbon is that it's very hard to predict what the impacts of climate change will be. And that's a climate scientist thing. And so a lot of the people who are trying to value the cost of carbon are not climate scientists themselves. And so they're taking information from other people that they may not fully understand and trying to put a dollar cost on that. The other thing is that when you do these kinds of things where the impacts are going to be far into the future, we do something called discounting. We have a discount rate. And what this means is we say, okay, usually discount rates are applied to investments. So let's say I offer you $100 now or $100 in the future. Which one would you prefer?
I would like it now.
Yeah, you would like it now. And, you know, the economists, if we're looking at people as totally rational, what they'd say is, well, what you would do is you would take that $100 and put it in the best investment that you can. So in a year from now, it should be worth $105 or $110, depending on how good you are at investing, rather than that $100. So what we would do is say, okay, well, I could give you $100 now or $110 in the future. And then those should be equal to you. So the discount rate is that saying, okay, something now is worth more than something in the future. But the question is, how much more is it worth in the future? So a lot of times discount rates are done based off of what economic growth should be or what the expected return on an investment would be. So, for example, one of the biggest climate models is the Dice model, and that one, they use a 4.5% discount rate. So that means that, okay, for every year that we're looking out to the future, the thing is going to be worth 4.5% less. Problem is that 4.5% is a little bit of an arbitrary number, and the models that we have for pricing carbon are really sensitive to what discount rate we use. And 4.5% is maybe a realistic expectation for, you know, the late 20th century when we had really good returns on investment, but it may not be so good an idea now. So 4.5% discount, with a 4.5% discount rate and all of these other assumptions, the Dice model predicts that the cost of a ton of carbon is $31 in 2016. But the thing is that if we had to change it to a 2% discount rate, then the cost of carbon is $140 per ton. So this is, you know, multiplying it by three times or something is a very big difference in what the cost of carbon is. And the problem is, I think when you look at politicians who are getting given these numbers when they're making policy, is they're thinking about that. They're saying, okay, well, if it's $37 a ton and it would cost us $50 a ton to do some kind of abatement, then we shouldn't do it. But given that there's so many assumptions that are going into these models that I think are really questionable, it is maybe not a very good idea to be giving people these kinds of numbers that are based on a lot of different assumptions. Another assumption I think is problematic is that for the most part, they're assuming that every additional ton of carbon that we emit is more costly than the last, because they're saying, okay, you know, if we have 1.5 degrees warming, it's less economically impactful than 2 degrees warming, right? Which that makes sense unless you look at some of the things like tipping point or feedback effects, in which case the carbon we emit now might be more impactful and worse than the carbon we emit after we get to that tipping point. And so I think those kinds of things make it really challenging to put a price on carbon. And I don't think that pricing carbon makes sense unless we are actually going to have some kind of carbon tax.
Yeah, you make some really good points there, and ones that I hadn't thought of to that extent. One of the things that does occur to me, you gave the example, okay, would you like to have $100 now or sometime in the future? But that mind experiment is about me. I mean, what if the mind experiment is, John, would you like to have $100 now, or would you like to have your great grandson's son have $1,000? And I mean, I'm going to be long gone then, and I don't know who the heck the guy is and all that other kind of, I said, you know, I'll take the $100 right now. So isn't that kind of what's happening in a sense that probably, almost certainly, the most severe impacts of climate change are going to happen down the road? They're certainly not going to be so much for my generation. I mean, I'm in my late 70s. And I actually hear people my age say, well, I'll be dead by then. Really, honestly, I do. I mean, I kind of cringe when I hear that. And they're making decisions and voting somewhat from that perspective. So doesn't the fact that the people that are going to be dealing with these bad outcomes are out there in the future, isn't that a really significant consideration?
Yeah, so I think that there's a few ways you can look at discount rate. The way that as I was saying, the way that most economists are looking at it is they're saying if we were to, so we have a decision, we can either spend, you know, $1 billion to stop some emissions now, and we know that that's going to prevent X number of dollars of damages in the future. Well, what if instead of putting $1 billion towards emissions, we invested $1 billion in some other kind of thing that will grow the economy? And if the economy grows by more than that number of damages, then we might be better off just growing the economy. So that's how economists are looking at it. The problem is, A, if we don't spend that $1 billion to avert emissions, to reduce emissions, I don't think it's anywhere near given that we're using that $1 billion to grow the economy, to doing something that will grow the economy. You know, I think that most likely we'll just use that $1 billion to consume something today. The other thing is, it's not just about, so when we're predicting what the damages will be 100 years from now, part of it is we don't know what the damages will be because there's so much uncertainty in climate science and those tipping points and all of those things. But another thing is we don't know what people are going to value in the future, where people are going to be. I mean, it could be by that point, you know, we've gone and colonized Mars and people don't care at all about what's happening on Earth. But I think it's more likely that people are going to be valuing coral reefs or summers without smoke or things like that a lot more in the future than they might be what we could predict right now. And so I think that the discount rate in that sense of, you know, what we're all our grandchildren care about is, again, something that's it's a problematic assumption. So,
yeah, it seems like the word problems is coming up a lot in this conversation, and I guess that's just the nature of the beast. So one of the things that you referred to earlier was that you've done some significant research around the subject of mobility. And I'm just wondering if there's anything you can, I mean, well, a brief background, we kind of can conclude that some places are going to do better and some places are going to do worse with climate change. Mm-hmm. And frankly, I think the Puget Sound here in northwestern Washington is going to be one of the places that does better, relatively speaking, than a place like, let's say, Florida or Texas. So what can we say about mobility in the framework of climate change, the way I just sketched it out?
Yeah, so I think some of my research is kind of getting at this idea that people do better when they have some geographic mobility. Their economic outcomes are better when they have the ability to move. And I think that that's something that right now we're not valuing very much. Right now we have this idea that people should be able to stay where they are. And that's a very important thing to us. And so we have, you know, the flood insurance and all of these things saying, you know, people should be able to move anywhere in the U.S. and we'll make sure to take care of them. And I, you know, that is a little bit of a problem because then you're setting up future generations. Suppose we then decide, actually, you know what, never mind, we're not going to provide this flood insurance. You're going to change, be setting these people up for some really hard economic times. So I think thinking about how all of these decisions will change how inequality is in the future is something that we ought to be thinking about right now. A book that came out somewhat recently is by Thomas Piketty, and it's called Capital and Ideology. It's a very long book, and you know there's a lot that is a problem with it, but his main point is we've justified inequality in different ways throughout human history. And so he looks at lots of time periods, lots of places. He looks at the caste system in India and feudalism in Europe and says, in each time, we found different ways to justify the structure of our society. And I worry that if we continue on to be in a place where we're justifying a very unequal society, when we are faced with all of these climate risks and climate impacts, we're going to be making all of these people are going to be kind of hosed. Whereas if we can figure out a way to, you know, change our economic backbone to be more fair and more equitable, I think that the climate impacts on inequality could be a lot different. So what I see right now is, you know, on the one hand, we have the opportunity to stave off climate change. And on the other hand, we also have an opportunity to change the way that we structure our economy so that it's more fair for everybody. And so I think that these economic and climate issues are, you know, the two most important issues to me. And they're something that I would like to see a lot more action done on.
Yeah, so it seems like along with all the reasons to worry about climate change related stuff, this is also a time of opportunity where we can look at where we've gotten ourselves as a species and take steps to not only save ourselves, but maybe make things better too. You allusion to feudalism and the caste system and there being rationalizations for those systems. And of course, the people that are at the top of the stack are usually the ones that make the rationalizations. And those rationalizations were basically about religion, you know, that God or Brahma or whoever, this is the way that entity wants these things. So I'll just ask this as a question. It seems to me that the thing that we're justifying inequity in our present system is the marketplace and the idea of individual property rights. It's like, okay, if I earn this, it's mine, it's not yours, and nobody else can have it. And we see this kind of cycle over and over where inequality between the wealthiest people in our system and the poorest people in our system expands. It kind of collapses back a little bit every once in a while. But so isn't the marketplace, this whole idea of the marketplace, the thing that people who support our present system point to?
The prison system thing isn't something that I think about a lot. I think generally inequality, though, and poverty and all of these things have been justified by, you know, earlier when I was saying the fundamental point of microeconomics is that markets do a great job of allocating resources unless they don't. And I think we focused a whole lot on that first part and not very much on that second part. And there's a lot of places where markets failed, where markets are not perfect, and they don't do a very good job at all. And economists have done a really good job of convincing people that, no, we're fine. The markets are doing great. And I don't think economists have done a good job about thinking about what the actual reality is. So we've definitely seen a movement in the field of people starting to look more at market failures. You mentioned a behavioral economist. I think behavioral economics is doing a good job of starting to change the way we think about things. But I think that economics is the thing that the field of economics has been used heavily to justify the inequality that we see today.
Okay, well, we're getting close to the end here. And so I'm just going to kind of throw out a hope of my own, because you mentioned you're a millennial and you're speaking about, I think I'm hearing you say something like, we need to take a closer look at what economists think and what they do and what they value. And my guess is that the old guys, quote unquote, are not going to be the ones that go there. And I'm glad that there are young economists coming into our philosophical pipeline, such as yourself, who are willing to take a fresh look. You don't have a stake in the traditional way of looking at economics. And so I find that I'm constantly looking for sources of hope. And so that's a little source of hope I've got there. So if you would kind of sum up for us what you think we as individuals, especially from an economist point of view, can and should be doing as we take our own efforts to address this problem.
Sure. So, you know, with that whole ideology aspect, a lot of what determines how good an economy is and how well it works for everybody is the institutions that we have. Mm-hmm. And so really, if there's one thing that I think is going to make sure we get on a good path, it's having a strong and stable democracy. We need people who are paying attention, getting involved, being informed, and, you know, listening to podcasts and being informed is the first step. But also, even when it feels like, man, if I just go march with that crowd of climate scientists or I write my senator, nothing's going to happen. Like, all of those little things add up. And I think it's really important to work on keeping that strong and stable democracy. And then, you know, again, there is the free rider problem. There's a lot of things where your individual actions probably won't affect things in the future. But I also think that one thing that needs to be explored is how culture and the economy come together. And right now we live in a culture where there is a lot of emphasis put on, like, who's traveling, who's got great cars and great clothes and all of these things. And taking the time to focus on things that are actually important, like community and meaningful work. I think that when we start to change the culture and what we believe goods means, what we believe, you know, a high quality of life is, if we can move the conversation away from GDP and all of those things to those other more meaningful aspects, ideology can play a huge impact on what kinds of change we see in the economy and the world. So, you know, again, it's small drops in the bucket, but it, I think, makes a difference in the end.
Well, your comments are really inspiring. They're inspiring to me, and they do point what I think is really beautiful human approach to looking into the future. So, Dr. Kelsey Carlston, Gonzaga University, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today. I've learned a lot, and I know our listeners have too.
Oh, great. Thank you.
Many thanks to Gonzaga's Dr. Carlston for describing some economic concepts and how they impact us in the real world. The better we understand the economics of climate change, the wiser we will be as we make our personal decisions and as we choose our elected leaders. Some of my key takeaways from Dr. Carlson's comments: 1, government and industry sometimes set policies that are harming us directly and will for a long time. We can influence those decisions by what we spend our money on and through the political process. 2, industry has financial incentives to pass costs off to others unless government prohibits them from doing so. 3, it's easy for us to think how little impact each of us has on worldwide issues like climate change, but collectively we do have an impact and each of us can be a player in determining our future. You can contact me at john@cctacoma.org for comments on this program or to make suggestions for future programs. This program, along with all other locally produced Radio Tacoma programs, can be found on the KTAH website under Programming. In the meantime, always live like the mountain is out. Take care now.